Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started.
In September 2018, I recorded the very first episode of Big Talk for Breeders. At that point, I really didn't have any expectations, but I certainly couldn't have imagined what Big Talk for Breeders was going to turn into. The situations and opportunities that it was going to bring into my life. And that's something that I've been incredibly grateful for. Between the breeder interviews that have taken place since and the public talks at shows like the Dublin Horse Show or Wellington International, we've now reached 40 episodes in the Big Talk for Breeders series. It really has been an incredible privilege to be a part of these conversations, and something that I've really, really enjoyed is hearing from people around the world and hearing what parts of conversations that really helped people or really resonated or struck a chord with various different people, with various different listeners around the world. At various stages over the last few years, I've been asked to do a solo episode, I guess as a way to share some of the key themes, my own learnings from having these conversations with such successful people in our industry, and to act as somewhat of a summary episode. It's not something that I was in a rush to do, because for me, the power and success of this podcast has been because it is a vessel to capture and share the stories and experiences of other people. This podcast hasn't been about me. Sometimes, however, there are opportunities to go on other people's podcasts and platforms. For example, the Swedish Warmblood podcast a number of years ago. And then most recently, back to Sweden again, when I was asked by Clara Norling, a young rider, breeder, and social media influencer, if I would do an interview with her for her own YouTube channel. That conversation was published a little over 1 month ago, and it was really nice to hear some of the feedback that Clara received and that I received. It's something that people seem to have gotten a lot of value from, and I got an opportunity to meet some of those people when I was at the Young Horse World Championships in Lanaken in Belgium. While I wasn't in a rush to do a solo episode of Big Talk for Breeders, I felt a compromise could be to ask Clara if it was okay to use the audio from the interview with her and to put that out as a separate episode of Big Talk for Breeders. It can be difficult for people to watch what is effectively a 1 hour long conversation on YouTube. A lot of the listeners of Big Talk like to listen to the episodes when they're doing something else, whether that's mucking out or on long drives or walks. So I felt that by making the audio from that conversation available as a Big Talk for Breeders episode, it would make it far more accessible to those who wish to consume it. A big thank you once again to Clara Norling for the opportunity to have a very enjoyable conversation with her and to join her on her own platforms. It's an interesting experience when you're used to being the person who asks the questions, when you have to take a different role and be the one to give the answers to the questions. But it was something that I really enjoyed. It's also brought me in contact with several people that I otherwise wouldn't have been in contact with. I guess particularly younger people that have an interest in sport horse breeding. So thanks once again to Clara. And if you're not already following her, please do check out Clara Norling on the various social media platforms. The conversation that follows is the direct audio from the interview that's on Clara's YouTube channel with nothing added and nothing taken away.
Have you ever wondered what goes on behind the scenes to build success in the horse world? Can you be successful starting from the bottom? How do you find partnerships, broaden your network, or find horses?
The other thing that I guess I don't see enough riders doing, whether that's younger riders, older riders, any rider who wants a greater network or more horses or better horses is...
In today's interview with breeder Michael Doherty, you'll find out exactly that. A lot of people discuss if it is possible to make it in the industry starting out with nothing.
Like if you just stay in your stable and sit there every day and think, it's really frustrating. How am I going to afford this horse? How am I going to find this horse? It's not fair that I don't have
millionaire parents that can just go out and buy me a Grand Prix horse. And then I'm thinking, really, what have you actually done to find that horse or to find the people who breed that horse or who have that horse?
Michael doesn't only show that it is possible, but also explains how. If you are ambitious, this video is a must.
We can justify things. We can give ourselves so many excuses on why we don't do something, why we're not achieving something, why we haven't reached our goal. And often we're in our own way. There are things that I did that have really worked for me, and having the pressure to have to make it work, because the best we can hope for is to try and increase the probability of success. I actually saw it as a huge advantage, not coming from the horse industry. I think sometimes if it's too easy, we leave a lot behind us. We leave a lot on the table. Instead of it being something that held me back, I think it's been one of the things that's been my greatest strength or advantage.
I've been obsessed with Michael's podcast for months because he gets the biggest names in our industry to open up about the real journey and how they got to where they are. Today, he is here to share his own journey as a breeder, what he's learned from interviewing some of the legends in our industry. Is there something that successful people have in common? How do you start out as a young rider or breeder? Grab a notebook and get comfortable, because we are diving deep into what separates dreamers from achievers.
What's maybe a little bit unusual in the horse world is because I don't consider myself from the horse world. I really only took an interest in horses around the time of going to, just before I went to university. So I ended up doing a degree called Equine Business, which was a business and management degree. But it had one module each semester where you learned about the horse industry. I wanted to do a business degree because I didn't know what I wanted to do. It was just an added bonus that once a week I got to listen to people talking about horses and the horse industry and got to learn it that way. Even though it was just for a summer, when I was working in the industry, especially for the main organization in the industry here, gave me the opportunity to be exposed to all different sides of the industry. I got to meet breeders, I got to meet riders, I got to meet the people who worked at shows. I got to meet such a broad cross-section of people. And also, you're working in front of like the database with all the pedigrees and the entire stud book. And it was just one of those opportunities that it's there for the taking if you want to take it. You could easily go in and do the same job and come away with very little. I had a hunger or a curiosity to really learn, and I was aware of how little I knew about horses and the industry. But instead of letting that put me off, I really threw myself into that and took every opportunity. I couldn't get enough of studying pedigrees and bloodlines, meeting breeders and trying to figure out why so many breeders never really achieve their goals and why a small number of breeders were so successful. To try and figure out why the successful ones were successful, but why the majority of breeders don't achieve what they want to achieve. Have I figured it out?
Have you figured it out? Yeah.
I think I figured out, I think I've seen enough patterns.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think that's what it all comes back to. You have to accept that in horses, whether you're breeding them or buying them, producing them, we're in an industry of uncertainty. The best we can hope for is to try and increase the probability of success. There's no 100% formula. Nobody can tell you, even though people will try and tell you, this is exactly how you need to do it. Nobody can actually guarantee you that will get you the result you're looking for. It might get you more in that direction, but they can't. I've yet to meet someone who had the exact perfect system that worked 10 out of 10 times.
Yeah.
But I could see patterns. So when I started in the industry, I thought it was going to be a huge disadvantage to be so young. When I looked around, breeders were mainly 3 and 4 times my age. I was coming into it around 20 or 21, and a lot of breeders were maybe retired age and things like that.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was, so it was a combination of being young, but really not having a clue. I thought that, I guess, that people wouldn't give me their time because I hadn't much knowledge. I was young. I wasn't wealthy. All those things that I thought were going to come against me. I actually saw it as a huge advantage, not coming from the horse industry. Instead of it being something that held me back, I think it's been one of the things that's been my greatest strength or advantage. Because you look at a very traditional industry where people are often born into it, and generation, like their
their parents did it. They might inherit a breeding program, a sports stable, and are heavily influenced by their parents or grandparents or some family members. Whereas I actually see the advantage when you can come into it completely fresh. When you come at it with fresh eyes and a real hunger to learn, you start to see why a lot of breeders struggle. When you step back and think of the components that make a breeding program or a breeder successful or help to make them successful.
Yeah.
And then you see what are the things that hold most breeders back? What, like, why are they not achieving success? Or why is it that there are so many breeders that may be a one-hit wonder, or they spend their life kind of frustrated breeding for decades? For me, there were some really obvious things. In 2013, I got the opportunity to buy a mare bred by one of the more successful breeders in Ireland, a man called Dr. Noel Cawley, someone else that owned it, and they were actually getting out of business or stopping with their breeding program. So there was an opportunity to buy that mare. While I had the opportunity, I didn't have the money, but I was determined that I was going to buy her. So I took out a loan and I bought the mare. And I had no real customers. There was no clear plan in terms of how I was going to get my money back. I knew I needed to buy this mare. I knew I needed to do whatever it was going to take to get the money together to try and buy her, because I thought this opportunity was too good to miss.
Yeah.
The family that she was from really impressed me. What her mother had produced had really impressed me. The fact that she was bred by Dr. Noel Cawley ticked a lot of boxes. She was in foal to flexible, and this was in 2013. The previous year, 2012, flexible had won the World Cup and finished in the top 10 of the Olympic Games. So even timing wise, to have a flexible foal coming, that was all good.
Yeah.
The experience then, I sold that foal remotely, privately, to someone I had never met before, to someone who had competed internationally with the foal sister at the time. And the whole experience of that first foal and having the pressure to have to make it work, because I'm not in a situation where if it went wrong that my parents could say, it's fine, you know, we'll pay your loan or we'll buy you a new one. But that was actually a big advantage rather than it being a disadvantage, because I think it's important that we all have enough of a fire lit under our ass that we actually go after what it is that we want. I think sometimes if it's too easy, we leave a lot behind us. We leave a lot on the table. That was really helpful, because then I had to really think about how do I go from no market, no clients. I couldn't just rely on, you know, family business, like in terms of existing clients, anything like that. So yeah, I had to get creative. And that whole experience was really useful. So what I did was learn and broaden my network and broaden my sales prospects. I tried to get in touch with everybody that had ridden a sibling or relation of the mare. I contacted them to ask about their horse and to tell them that I had just bought the sister, and to ask about the traits of their horse. I wanted to build a picture of the common themes, the commonalities of the family, strengths and weaknesses, but in also doing it and approaching it from curiosity and reaching out to someone rather than reaching out to try and sell them something. I was also letting them know what I had.
I think if you've been in the industry for a while and you have this certain way of thinking, I don't think a lot of people would actually even think about doing that. But
no.
I think it's very smart.
It's free.
Yeah.
Because I think in life, not just in horses, we can justify things. We can give ourselves so many excuses on why we don't do something, why we're not achieving something, why we haven't reached our goal. And often we're in our own way. There are things that I did that have really worked for me without much money and without any sort of network. It was just things that made sense to me. Because if you actually think through the steps of, okay, I have this horse, who are the people that are likely to be interested in this? Well, firstly, the people who have been successful with the brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. And I think now, 12 years later, that seems maybe more obvious than when I had that first foal. It was so easy and free to track people down. That's the beauty of social media. Everybody is accessible. One of the people I contacted, we stayed in touch. She ended up buying the first foal off me. She ended up buying the second foal. And the third foal, we are still great friends. And she's someone that I also learned a lot from because she was competing internationally at a good level. The other thing that I try not to do is pretend that I know more than I do, whether it was with that particular person, Jesse Dre in England, or other people that I meet. If I really don't know something, I tell them I don't know or haven't a clue or I know nothing about that. Can you explain it to me? I feel in the horse industry, everyone is trying to pretend that they know more than they do, but then they never learn the things that they don't know because they're either afraid to ask, afraid to look stupid, going, oh, I've been around horses too long, I should know that. Mm. Whereas I've gone the other way. The first time that I actually met Jessie, we had done business two or three times before we ever met.
Yeah.
It was just buying them. It was trust and it was over messages and calls. We'd never met. But the first time we actually met in person was at a horse show. And I actually sat down with her and I said, can you explain to me what you see? Because I said, I've never ridden. I can't ride. That's the other thing people expect of your breeder. It's like you used to ride and either you aren't good enough or you got hurt. But I've never ridden. To be really open with people and say, look, I don't know that, or I don't know the thing that you're good at. Can you explain it to me? And people are happy to explain it. So that was really helpful. So that was a little bit about how the breeding program started. And then something that happened over the next few years, I didn't intentionally do it this way, but it's, I'm now in a situation where the majority of the horses that I own, I probably own somewhere between 15 and 20 horses at the moment. Mm. And almost all of them are owned in partnership with somebody else. Not even that they're all owned in partnership with the same person. They're owned in partnership with people in Ireland, Holland, the USA, and it's just developed that way for a few reasons. I was open to work with people. Mm. If you're genuine with people and people can see your enthusiasm, especially when you're younger, I think people give you chances. And it's like back to what we were just discussing, but sometimes I think the most important thing you can say or the most freeing thing you can say in the horse world is, I don't know. Because then when you do know something or have an opinion, it has more value because you're not afraid to admit when you don't know.
Yeah.
It's freeing because we all have strengths and weaknesses. With partnerships, sometimes it's that people don't have, they have an interesting horse, but don't have the time. They have a mare that needs to be retired, but don't have the space. It could be like I've done partnerships with people where we bring different things to the table and that's what makes it interesting. It allowed me to build up a breeding program that I'm really happy with very little money. If I had to go and actually buy my breeding program and out and try and buy, have all the same mares and have it for myself, it would have taken me a long, long time. So the combination of being able to see the strengths and weaknesses of lots of other breeding programs in Ireland and throughout Europe, and then doing partnerships with people that had interesting mares or maybe buying fillies together, I saw that a lot of people were breeding from mares that weren't good enough. A lot of people were too focused on what the mares were rather than what the mares did, what the mares bred, what the dam lines did. And again, I'm talking 12 years ago.
Yeah.
It has changed a lot since then. Breeders typically have a very small network or no network. And typically, a lot of breeders have zero marketing or promotion of their breeding program. So I was looking at the majority breeding programs thinking, how could this ever succeed? Because all the factors that I see in successful breeding programs are all the logical factors that would contribute to a successful business or breeding program don't exist.
Yeah.
The ingredients are wrong. The supply chain or the network, the route to market doesn't exist. There's no promotion of it. Nobody's going to know about it. So my only surprise was in people being surprised that their breeding programs weren't delivering the results.
Mm.
In terms of if you're a young person and you would like to be broadening your network, meeting more people that you could learn from or collaborating with other people, there's a whole bunch of things. I don't think there's just one thing. And I don't think it's as simple as just messaging people on social media. I think especially for young riders, what I would like to see more of from young riders is there's a lot of young riders can talk about maybe it's hard to afford buying the type of horse they need or want or finding it, but they don't put themselves in the places where those horses are. Like if you just stay in your stable and sit there every day and think, it's really frustrating. How am I going to afford this horse?
how am I going to find this horse? It's not fair that I don't have millionaire parents that can just go out and buy me a Grand Prix horse. And then I'm thinking, really, what have you actually done to find that horse or to find the people who breed that horse or who have that horse? What I'm really happy with is when I do a breeders event and there are young riders in the room, because I'm thinking, you're the clever ones. Even if you're not breeding, you are now the outliers. You are the ones who bothered to turn up to sit in a room full of breeders. Also, these are the breeders that are quite engaged because they've come to a breeding event. So yeah, you're probably getting in the right type of people. And then because you're the only two or three riders that bother turning up, your chances of getting talking to all these other breeders are significantly higher. But the other thing that I guess I don't see enough riders doing, whether that's younger riders, older riders, any rider who wants a greater network or more horses or better horses, is a lot of riders have never initiated the contact with the breeders of their horses. If I was a younger rider, I would be looking at the horses that I have currently, and I would be reaching out to the breeders of those horses, or even the people who have the relations of the horses, and give them some value, update them on the horses, send them videos, send them pictures, keep in touch, develop a relationship. I think the only reason that somebody reaches out to us is when they want something. So I think if you can develop relationships by giving feedback and updates, say for instance, even when you put up a post, if the horse has done something, say you go out and you win a competition, and you'll see this if you look at 1,000 posts over the next month of horses that have gone out and won a competition, 999 of them will not reference who bred the horse.
True. So
there's nothing, like there's nothing ever coming back. When you're a breeder, there's not enough riders that reach out and go, here's a video of the horse, or I'm really happy that we just won here or placed here, or I'm really happy with how the horse is going, or what else have you had from the mare? Yeah. Are they similar to what I have? You know, here's the strengths and weaknesses. Build a relationship. You're educating yourself. You're educating the breeder. The more a breeder can interact with the riders, the more knowledgeable the breeders are, the better the horses they can breed. And then as a result, they have a relationship, because all breeders that are not just, if you're selling as foals, that's different. Or if you're just someone who goes to auctions with the foals, again, that's different. But if you're someone who would like to actually keep horses, put them under saddle, produce them in the sport, the majority of breeders are looking for options. They're looking for riders that they can trust, that have the capabilities to produce young horses and the decency to treat the people well. One of the greatest challenges is finding people who have the skill set who will treat the horse right and treat the human right.
And I also feel like breeders are usually so passionate about what they are doing. And it's like always this topic that breeders don't get as much attention or things back as the riders who are in the spotlight. So I can also imagine that it's really appreciated.
I would like to see more people, I would like to see more people working together, even as a support network.
Yeah.
Because if people could meet more, speak more, travel together more, a lot of what we do, we're all operating in isolation. And it's far easier to get the motivation to go to a meeting or a conference or an event or a breeder or stable that you're inspired by, or some event that you'd really like to go to, if you can do it with other people with a similar interest. For me, developing that circle within the horse world or that network, and then all learning together, traveling together, it's when you're in those situations or those environments that I think those maybe discussions to do something together come up more naturally.
Yeah.
Or an opportunity comes up where you're at an event, you're at an auction, you're at a breeder's place, and you're thinking, I really like that foal, or I really like that horse, but I don't have the money. And you're thinking, okay, well, you know, why don't we go 50-50? Maybe you raise it. Maybe I back it. You know, maybe you keep it to four. I produce the rest so that we're keeping the cost down, or do it together.
Yeah.
I think it's really important, though, when you're choosing the person that you're choosing to do the partnership with is as important as the horse, if not more important. Because if you have a super horse and a not so super person, it's not worth it. So I think with the people that you're involved with, it's important that you're morally aligned and that you have similar goals or outlooks. You can have different skill sets, because I think that's an advantage. For example, when I got some of the horses in partnership, we had the space here. We had a nice farm. It was a nice place to raise horses. but some of the people they did it in partnership with, maybe they're more knowledgeable on the sport, or they had ridden, or they have more business experience in the horse world that I could learn from. But I really think it's important that you go into it with people that your gut feeling is that you can trust them, because horses, and especially breeding in horses, is already difficult enough without getting into a partnership with someone that you clash with or have conflict with. The danger sometimes, while partnerships have been overall quite positive for me, the danger also is when you're in partnership with someone, what they do and how they do it also affects you. So if you're selling a horse together, you want to make sure that they also won't have a negative impact on your business or your reputation. And I think that also helped me move a little bit quicker than I would have by myself. People that were far more experienced and successful were open to doing partnerships with me. You go from being somebody with no track record or somebody that's kind of newer. But then when other people are looking from the outside in, they're thinking, oh, well, that person did a partnership with them, and that person, and they're all quite successful. Once you find those people, in some instances, maybe somebody offered a partnership. In other instances, with one particular person, I felt they were looking for a solution. They needed to retire a mare that they had competed successfully. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel that they wanted to sell the mare. They just needed a solution because they didn't have a place to put the mare. But I knew how much they thought of this mare. And they were asking different questions about breeding. And I was answering the questions, but I just thought it costs nothing to suggest it. And I asked them, would they consider doing a partnership where they'd send the mare to Europe? This mare was in the USA. And then we discussed how we would handle the costs and responsibilities, and that we'd own all the offspring 50-50. And that allowed me to get mares that I would have never been able to afford or have access to. In another situation with a friend in Holland, he does a lot of business, and he's a super, super guy, and I learned a lot from him. His experience in Ireland was not always positive, and the Irish don't always have the best reputation when it comes to the horse world. So I wanted to make it clear when I was getting to know him that I was different, because everyone else was just maybe trying to sell a problem or trying to sell a horse quickly and not disclosing information. And I thought by suggesting that we did a partnership together, it was sending out a very clear message that I was very serious about this being a long-term approach. I want relationships and business to be long-term. I'm not interested in quick sales, quick turnarounds where someone's a loser. I want everything to be long-term. This person is very successful. And I thought, again, I have nothing to lose by proposing it. And I proposed doing a mare and partnership together. And they said immediately, yes. That was a great confidence boost that someone of that caliber was so quickly open to doing something together. It had the desired effect because it did show them that I wasn't interested in just catching them with something, or that I wanted to really, really build a partnership and a long-term relationship. And several years later, we're still friends. We're still doing partnership. We've done partnerships now on another horse. That's been very positive. I think an ideal scenario is if you're a young rider that has a long-term approach and vision, wants to do things properly in terms of how horses are produced, treated, and how people are treated, then I think there are a lot of breeders who will be very open to doing partnerships, and that relationship, like I mentioned earlier, can really, really benefit both sides, where both are winners. Nobody is winning at the expense of somebody else. If you can find a breeder who consistently breeds above average horses, and they can have a rider that they know that they can trust, it's a direct supply chain. You do not have to worry about where your next horse is coming from, because they're going to breed it, they're going to raise it.
Yeah.
Potentially, one way I've seen working quite well is breeders might raise it until it's three. It goes to the rider when it's ready to be trained sometime in its three-year-old year. The rider has no costs in breeding it. The rider has no costs in raising it for the first 3 years. And then it goes to the rider. The breeder has no costs. The breeder has a chance to be a part of something that often they can't afford. Mm. And the rider is getting a horse that they haven't had to try to breed or raise, because a lot of the time, maybe the riders might have a sports stable, but they don't have acres and acres and acres of, you know, free paddocks. So those breeder rider relationships, I think if the people both approach it with the same moral compass and are not trying to win at the expense of the other person, that can be incredibly successful and fruitful. With the partnerships, I have
I have partnerships here where a number of us own a horse together and we all split the cost. I have partnerships where two of us might buy something 50-50. With one friend, we bought a filly foal 50-50, and then all the way through, we just split every cost 50-50.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, there's others. There's one particular mare where it's a group that are involved and we split the costs based on our percentage of ownership. Then I have other mares where I didn't have to buy into the mare. It, particularly with the three mares that came from the USA, the owners sent them to Europe. And then when they arrive in Europe, they're my responsibility. And we agree in advance what way the costs are working. The majority of the costs are mine because I haven't had to buy into the mare. I have all the responsibilities and the management. And then when the horses are three, then we start to split the costs again. Their mare is being looked after somewhere. They don't have lots of bills. Yeah. They still have the fun and interest of having offspring coming along without any pressure of having to manage them.
Mm.
And also then by doing partnerships with different people, everybody has a different network, some small, some big, some high end, some more local. If we now have a really promising young horse, it means we have the benefit of both the networks. I've very deliberately put a lot of effort into creating and broadening my network, and these co-owners have networks in different countries and different markets. And it just means that it really increases your chances of getting paid, your chances of it being a success. When I started doing partnerships, a lot of people were, when I would talk about it, the majority of people will rush to tell you why you shouldn't do it and how risky it is. Not every partnership has worked out. Not every horse has worked out. Sometimes it's the people, sometimes it's the horse. But I think if I look back, I would say that the majority of the partnerships I've been involved in, I would consider positive. Sometimes even if the horse didn't work out, I learned a lot from the experience of having that horse or because I had a horse from a particular family, or it was with a rider that I hadn't worked with before, or I got in contact with the breeder and then I got to know them. I got to know people, breeders or riders that had relations. I don't always look at it as we bought it for this and we sold it for this. And unless it was a profit, it's like either positive or negative. If I benefited, whether that's knowledge or network or financial return, it's positive.
So also, to be very clear from the start, is probably the most easiest thing.
Clarity on goals and responsibilities. And even to have it in, okay, I'll cover this, you cover this. If we have a problem in terms of, say, veterinary, for example, I might have a situation where I cover all the breeding costs and the raising costs. But if there's any non-routine veterinary, like any emergency veterinary, we split that 50-50. If we have a daughter of one of these mares that we want to breed, so now we're out of the next generation, then we split all that 50-50 because that's not the original partnership or agreement. With some of them, I might have something in it that if for any reason I want to sell and you don't want to sell, the other person has the first option to buy out. So with some of the ones that I have here, some of the co-owners will have the opportunity and have done so. Sometimes I'll want to sell a foal because I'll need the sale. They don't need the sale. They're happy to keep it, so they'll buy my share. And sometimes we might do it in a way that it's okay, this is the price that we were trying to sell it at in the public market, but as co-owners, we can do it a different way or things like that. But I think if you can have as much clarity at the beginning, that's great. And then you can decide to be flexible when the time comes. But at least if you have that clarity and focus and that you both want, that you're both setting out wanting the same thing is very helpful.
I'm curious if the podcast has helped you when it comes to networking and collaborations, because obviously
definitely
you, I can imagine it's like an excuse, first of all, to talk to very interesting people. And then also people are listening and knows who you are.
So the podcast has brought me in contact with lots of new people. Like what you said, it is a perfect excuse. Even with what you're doing, us talking now, it's like, when do you have an opportunity otherwise where you can just say, can we talk for an hour? Like message someone on Instagram, go, can we have a chat for an hour? That's what's great in the horse industry. We already have an excuse to talk to people, but we don't really use that enough. A lot of the time it's, oh, I'd love to talk to them, but no, I can't, or they're too high profile, or they won't be interested in what I have to say. It's like the person's so happy to talk about their horses and what they're doing. And that's what we want to hear. We want to hear what they're doing and about their horses. It's not often that you're going up to someone, I really want to talk to them because I want to tell them about what I'm doing. Well, we talk ourselves out of this, but it's such a good excuse to be able to just email somebody or message somebody and say, I have this podcast and I'd like to interview you about your breeding program or your career. And that has been really interesting because also then it's quite an intimate thing. So if I'm interviewing someone, we'll talk a bit before the interview. I'll interview them for maybe an hour and a half. We'll probably talk a bit afterward. For a lot of the interviews, I've done them in people's homes. So I might spend a whole evening with somebody and you might have dinner with them and with the family and the whole thing. People have cried in the interviews. You know, people get very comfortable with you. They answer very openly. That's my whole goal, is to make people relaxed and get more emotion. Or encourage people to communicate more emotion. Then you have this kind of connection afterwards because you've both shared this thing. There are people now that I've developed friendships with and are really happy to see each other when we see each other at a show, or you keep in touch, or you support each other's breeding program. Yeah. But then on top of it, I think it has also given me other opportunities where people do business with me because of it. So either looking to source something, to source horses, source broodmares. I have a particular family, a Canadian family, that they have now bought 6 or 7 of my foals and another foal through me. It was the podcast. That's how they found me. And they bought the first few foals before we ever met. We never even had a phone call. And and then on top of it, it's resulted in friendships and relationships. People I now work with them in communication with regularly. It's brought me on different trips. I've done breeders talks in Sweden. Myself and Emma Thorian Helston, the former Swedish warm blood breeding manager, like it resulted in us doing a breeder's trip and working with breeders in New Zealand. It's just been incredible.
That's something that I'm trying to experiment myself with, building a personal brand.
Yeah, and it's a lot easier to not do it because then there's no risk, there's no negatives. It's not all positive either. You will have some people that, because of their own insecurities and unhappiness with their own life, they will try and stop you or bring you down. I also think some people, it's generally people that are not successful, because there are no successful people that will ever try and put you down. But there are a small number of people who will, they're not happy with you getting airtime or having success, especially if they perceive you to like be an outsider or come from nowhere. Generally, it's probably a bit confronting for people.
This topic fascinates me because personal branding is everywhere in business except the horse world. It's barely been touched here. And when I talk to people from other industries, they're generally shocked. Wait, you're telling me that a $1 billion industry doesn't use basic marketing? And it's true, the equestrian world somehow skips fundamental business principles that every other sector considers standard. This was something I kept thinking about when I was working in stables myself. I just couldn't figure out why it was this way. So I was really interested to hear Michael's perspective on it.
But because you said you had a business degree, right? As someone who's very interested in business, I sometimes think that the horse industry is not really following business advice.
Yeah, it's a disaster.
What is your thoughts on it?
I think the horse industry, in a lot of cases, is not run like a business. What I saw in the earlier years was that it wasn't run like a business. People weren't treated like customers or clients. A lot of the time it feels like the horse industry looks at people to just what can it extract from them, that they don't look enough about building a relationship and meeting the needs of the clients and customer satisfaction or trying to retain clients or anything. Yeah. Anything that you would cover in any sort of basic business marketing degree. I'm glad that I am more drawn to the business and marketing side. But also the thing is, if you take the average profile of the professional rider, they might grow up in an environment where from a very young age, they're in a high pressure competitive environment where it mightn't be just that they want to pursue this. It might be that family are putting a lot of pressure on them to go out and deliver. A lot of professionals don't have a childhood and a lot of them leave school at the first opportunity. The combination of while there are lots of riders that travel around the world to compete, they're not very worldly. They don't really have much life experience beyond a show jumping ring. From a young age, it becomes all about competing and winning and the pursuit of winning. There's not much interest or room for interest beyond that, exposure to the world and how the rest of the world works and a realization of how broken parts of the horse industry are. They don't have the opportunity to step beyond it. Not even the opportunity. Sometimes they don't take the opportunity either. So I think even in our conversation, and I get the feeling that you probably have a similar approach
But for the past 10 or 15 years, while I've tried to consume everything that I can find on the horse industry, I spend as much time consuming as much as I can get beyond it, looking for inspiration beyond the horse industry. Because if I only look for inspiration within the horse industry, then I only just do what everybody else is doing. But if I look for inspiration beyond it, whether that's business books, audiobooks, podcasts, marketing, luxury branding, you know, that was one thing that a number of years ago, when I quit my job, I had all these ideas in my head and I had all these question marks over how the industry approached marketing and selling horses. It just seemed like it just did not make sense, that there wasn't enough acknowledgement that what we're producing, what we're training, what we're trying to sell is a luxury good.
Yeah.
Because how we try and promote it and sell it was like so much like if it was just a commodity or some random product that you sold in a shop. So I really wanted to put the different learnings or insights from other sectors and how luxury goods can and should be promoted. That's when I made this mare brochure, and I made it based on trying to switch the conversation from all about stallions and how great the stallion was to focusing on the mares, how great those mares were and their families, really highlighting them, trying to do it in a really clear, accessible, high level, aesthetically pleasing, that to try and promote my breeding program, not just like on some random classified site that here was a foal for sale, that to promote it in a way that communicated, I guess, my values, how serious I was about my own breeding program. And that when you held this, when you looked at it, when you felt it, when you read it, it was like this nearly multi-sensory experience. I regularly consume content outside of the industry, seeking inspiration for inside the industry.
It's something that I have been thinking about a lot. Obviously, I need to be a good rider and the horse needs to be good. But also, if you think about it from a business aspect and that your stable is also a business, both if you're a breeder, dealer or rider, to do exactly what everyone else is already doing is maybe not the best business idea. It feels like a lot of people are doing the exact same thing.
I think whether it's you or any younger rider listening to this conversation, if you treat people like an actual valued customer or client and that you keep to your word, treat them well, treat them like human beings, treat them like a customer. When you say something, stand by it in your words and in your actions. If you say something or you make a commitment to someone, do that in a way and stick to that in a way as if you had almost put it in a legal contract, without doing anything clever, without having to spend a fortune on a fancy premises, you will already stand out much more. Because a lot of people are trying to get by on just their ability to ride a horse and don't value all the rest of it. And they chop and change through owners and roll on to the next owner and they find another owner, or horse breaks and they move on, find another horse. It's really short-term, narrow-minded. I don't really understand it. But also, I think sometimes, even on social media, there's a fear of judgment and sometimes people taking themselves too seriously. With a lot of profiles and a lot of businesses, people really shy away from being seen or being heard. But it's like, it's your business, like it's your name above the door, or it's you that's riding these horses.
When I realized that social media had a value, when people started asking if they could buy a horse from me, and it wasn't a specific horse, it wasn't the horse they wanted to buy, it was just, I want to buy from you. Maybe I was like, yeah, I don't have any horses, but in the future. But yeah, and it also struck me like, oh, why are not other people doing this more?
Because it's like, it's much harder to trust someone that you can't see.
One thing that I'm super interested about hearing, because you've talked to so many top riders, breeders, and people in the industry, is there something that you noticed that they have in common that have made them so successful?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's easier just to speak to the breeders. And I've said this probably in lots of different ways or talks or articles, but the successful breeders have been so focused on exceptional mares, really special mares, or special mares from special families, that the standards they hold themselves to or require are significantly greater than
the average breeder. I think a lot of the time the average breeder gets caught up on who the father is, who the mother's father is, and they go, oh, she's really well bred.
No.
She's not really. You know, anyone can go out and pick whatever stallion they want. It's like the whole thing, you know, you can put some top stallion on a donkey, you still have half a donkey. So that with these breeders, they have really focused on a small number of really exceptional mares and really special families.
Mm.
And just the general standards that they hold themselves to are much higher. A lot of the time with successful breeders, they're strong characters and they're, I think, less influenced by the opinions of others. They're very focused on what they're trying to do and where they're trying to go. Yeah, I think it's a lot of it is just comes back to standards. Their focus isn't as much on what stallions they use. Their success is on the mares at the center of their breeding program and how good they are. And the standards that they hold themselves to and what they consider to be good. And that was something in the early years when I was looking around at watching different horses or meeting different breeders. When I got exposed to some of the best breeders, it was just worlds apart in terms of standards, focus and commitment. They were just operating at a different level. And also, I think with some of them, their willingness to take risks as well. I think a lot of the time breeders play it too safe. They buy the cheap mare or they just breed with the mare that they were given because that's less scary than going out and actually investing in something. Now, if the mare you were given you really believe in, then you go for it. But a lot of the time when you have conversations with breeders and you ask them the difficult questions, they don't really believe deep down that their mares are going to get them to where they want to go. But it's some other fear or some other excuse that stopped them from changing that. That's a big thing. I think what's comforting, though, it's very easy when you're younger or starting off with the breeding program to look and go, you know, these people are so successful and they're operating at a different level that I could never be operating at, or it's going to take me too long, or I don't have the money, or I don't believe that I have met a breeder, a successful breeder, where I thought they were successful in every aspect of their business. Whether that's they might be very good at breeding horses, they might be terrible at marketing their horses, they might be very poor at dealing with people. We all have strengths and weaknesses. Some of us will be better at marketing and communication. All of them still have areas that they could improve on. And I think sometimes by knowing that or hearing that, it can be comforting rather than thinking that they have it all figured out. One of the things that I have been the most pleasantly surprised by is their willingness to give you their time. Because when you're starting off, you can talk yourself out of all these situations and think, oh, I'd love to visit this breeder. I'd love to see their breeding program. I'd love to visit their farm. I'd love to meet them or have a conversation with them. But then you're like, oh yeah, but I'm too young. I don't have any knowledge. Like, why would they want to talk to me? I don't have any money. Yeah. I'm not a potential customer. So they're not going to be interested, or they're too busy and I'm not going to contact them.
Mm.
And I would say probably 90% of every breeder I've ever contacted, either to visit or to interview, has said yes.
Mm.
And that's from the beginning. Yeah. It's not that just, oh, now they want to say yes because this is a podcast and it might be good for their business or something like that. Before there was any podcast, before I had any sort of a breeding program, I was really happy or pleasantly surprised by how many people said yes to me coming and visiting their farm and learning about their breeding program. But then when you step back, it makes sense. If you're a young, enthusiastic person who has positive intentions and you're coming to ask them about them and their horses and their breeding program and their life's work, kind of makes sense why they'd be happy to talk about it. Mm. And a lot of the time, when you are an enthusiastic younger person, they can probably also see elements of themselves in you. They were once that person that was going around doing the same thing.
Yeah,
I think they appreciate it because it amazes me how few breeders actually do it or how few riders do it. So that's what I mean. I've said it once or twice in different ways, but just by doing some of these things, you automatically stand out. And the majority of people are not doing it. The majority of people are not reaching out to riders to come and see their stable, reaching out to breeders to see their breeding program. And by putting yourself in those situations, then it's like you think, oh, they're so busy. They have people every day of the week. Some of these breeders, they don't. They have actually very few people that are visiting them. Because everyone presumes they're busy.
Would this be an advice for riders to do more of as well?
100%. Because there was a young girl near here contacted me maybe about 2 years ago. And I don't know why, but I just, at the end of the call, I said, I'm going to give you homework. And I said, I want you to write down the answers and I want you to send them back to me. And I want you to put the date on it as well. But it was around what's your ultimate breeding goal, like establishing establishing that breeding goal, like what you were just talking about with the breeders, I asked her to write a list of the breeders who in the next 5 years they would love to have the opportunity to meet. And I think maybe I did the same with riders and then with the show that you would like to attend. Because if you're going to be a breeder, it's really important that you expose yourself to the breeders who have been successful in the space that you want to be successful in. It's essential that you meet the riders you're trying to breed horses good enough for, both to know them, to broaden your context or network, but also to learn from them. And then the same with the shows. It's like people will say, oh, I want to breed a horse that's good enough to jump at this championship. At a minimum, you should be watching it every time it's on. You should be watching top level show jumping regularly. I remember the first time that I went to Geneva, I was just so impressed. It's fine. I'd probably watched various different editions and rounds online, but I was so impressed seeing it in person. The level being operated there was incredibly impressive. I had been at the European Championships that summer in Aachen, and Geneva impressed me more. Seeing it in person, or sometimes you'll see a horse that you're interested in or a stallion that you're interested in, and you'll actually come away with a different impression than you have just watching on videos. So that's why for me, I was trying to get her to be really clear and think about what is the goal. So whether you're a rider or a breeder, what's the ultimate goal in 10, 15, 20 years? What's the thing that you would like to have achieved in your whole career? What's the thing you'd like to achieve in, if you were to write down as a breeder or as a rider, if you had to write down five names, five breeding programs throughout the world or throughout Europe or even in your own country, if we're having this conversation and even in 2 years, 5 years might be too long, in 2 years time, and I want you to do this as well. Who are the riders that you, if we had this conversation in 2 years time, who are the riders that, write down five names, who are the riders that you want to have at least met, if not visited? And then if you are really interested in learning and developing the breeding side of things, who are the five breeders, the breeders programs that you want to have visited this time 2 years? Write it down and put the date on it and put it up somewhere. Put it up. Do you have a vision board or a notice board?
Not yet. I have been thinking about trying it out maybe.
Take a picture of it and send it to me, please.
Okay.
Because then it makes it also more accountable, and then you'll do it because you've told someone. And even if in 2 years' time you've only done half of it, it's already such a win. And it'll inspire you. Each one inspires you and pushes you on. And then once you've done it, it's a compliment to somebody that you think that much of them that you want to hop on a plane or drive a few hours to come and visit them. And even if it is a thing that you start in Sweden, like there's some great breeders in Sweden, some lovely people. It's amazing the domino effect what happens once you start doing it. And then it's like you can't stop. Each one gets easier and easier. And then it gets to the point where it's not that you don't feel anything. You can still get nervous, or sometimes I have to give myself a talking to if I'm thinking, I want to go talk to them, and then think, oh, no, don't. And I'm like, what? Like, what are you doing? Just do it. Just go and speak to them.
Yeah.
And it's rare that you regret it.
I feel so inspired now. Also, really this thing with networking and just like put yourself out there. And also this thing that you talked about in the beginning, like look up your horse's pedigree, see which one has the siblings of your horse and reach out to them, because then you still have some connection and like, why not?
The thing is, I think you're also in a very good situation because you have taken the biggest step, the step that most people won't take. You've gone past that discomfort of like stepping into the light. I think you can really use that as a like force for good. And that's the thing that I try and keep coming back to when I do events and I create content. It's to keep doing it with the greater good in my mind, the things that can benefit. And sometimes it's going against things. Sometimes I know it's going to cause problems with an organization or something politically. I don't mean I don't go out looking to cause trouble, but sometimes I know maybe something won't be popular with an organization or something like that. But something that I would really like to see you do, as well as the homework, the list, is also to write down how you can develop a community, not just digitally, that along with developing your digital community, how can you kind of put together like even just a core group? And maybe you already have this, but for me, what was really helpful in the early years was having a few people who had a similar interest, who I got on well with, who were interested in traveling and having these experiences that I was having.
Yeah.
And what has been incredibly beneficial was I was the person who was seeking out these experiences. I just tried to get over myself good and early in terms of being afraid to approach people, email people. So I was organizing the visits, the trips, the meetings. Even though I didn't know these people, it was like I was making it easier for the other people to come along. And now what I've continued to try and do, and now I've developed quite a good network internationally at this point, but I keep bringing people with me and then like creating situations where they can all benefit from that as well. And I think that's good. It lifts everything for everybody, but also it's kind of more fun because I do lots of trips by myself, but it's nice if you can develop like a network, a group. Maybe it's like a group of young riders all within an hour from you that you once a quarter, once a month, do something outside of a show, like where you meet up, even make it social. Or I worked with breeders groups in Ireland where you create a formal breeders group and people join up to it, and then you meet maybe like five times a year. And each different night, there's a different topic. You could do like mini events that don't really cost much money, or everybody chips in a little bit and covers the costs. And it's an excuse to like bring people together. And because often there can be people operating in the same area as you that you don't know. You've never had a reason, or maybe they're people that you just say hello to at a show, but you've never actually had a conversation with them. But then through organizing different things, either it's bringing a group together or you're thinking, oh, I'd be interested in that person, and getting them into like talk or arrange, when you do get a few people together, then like arranging these visits that people can all go together, because you are going to be more comfortable than the average person doing that because you've already done this. You can be the person that like clears that path and then brings people with you.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because outside of the horse world, we have friend groups where like, oh, that's a friend from school, or that's a friend from college, or that's a friend from this job. But it's harder then to bring them all together. But in the horse world, everybody has this common language because we're all into horses.
Yeah.
And something that while I do all these events, sometimes it's nice to actually just do like a dinner or go somewhere for a dinner, but they together bring with mix them. Because if you're thinking, okay, I like you and I like you and I like you, and I think that you'd actually like each other, but you haven't had the opportunity to meet, be the person who creates the opportunities. Because it's amazing, like, it's very satisfying doing all this. Most of us are happy just staying in our own little bubble because it's less scary. But you can push people's comfort zones in it, like in a safe way, like with good intentions. What I started doing then, we have an old converted like granary, it's like where we turned a shed into a house. It's an Airbnb property. But now on the 1st of January each year, I just have a really small event where I invite a few of these people from around the country that I like, and I think, you know, they like each other or they will like each other. We just, because people will have New Year's plans, but they mightn't have on the evening of the 1st, there's usually nothing on. So, and they're not back to work yet. So I invite them to come here. There's beds for everybody. I just send them a menu for an Indian nearby. They tell me what they want. There's no pressure on somebody cooking, and they turn up and can just have food and drinks and have the chat. There's not like, oh, I'm busy at a show, I have these horses, I better go, I have, you know, horses in the trailer, I have to get home and feed. It's like, this is just like away from everything. They're free from family, they're free from responsibilities, and they can just relax. In the last 2 or 3 years, my girlfriend Charlotte has started making like an equine quiz, sport and breeding, and she runs the quiz, and it creates a little bit of extra fun for people, and we have a prize and things like that. It's a great way of making a really solid community because it makes it less hard, because what we're choosing to do and what we're choosing for our lives is brutal. To try and make it as a rider, to run a business in the equine world, to be a breeder, it's a really weird form of self-harm we choose for ourselves. And if you try and do it alone, I think that's probably why it has such an effect on people, because it's hard, but then they're like taking all that themselves. And then they think they're doing something wrong because they're having all this bad luck. When they look online, everybody's having such success because people aren't sharing the downsides. So that's what I'd like. Before this, I've never met you and I'm giving you all these roles and responsibilities.
I love it.
but that's why I think And even if it's just like start small, start in the area, but write down some ideas on how like-minded people could be brought together for group benefit. And you'll be amazed what comes out of it.
Yeah. I'll have this as my mission now.
I would like you to find out where your nearest breeders group is and join it. Don't think, well, I'm not really a breeder. I only just have one or two and I'm more a rider. Be the rider in the room full of breeders.
Yeah.
And that will pay dividends. That will, like, in a few years time, you'll be thinking, I'm so happy I did that.
There are always these events and stuff going on. Also, I think a lot of young people also don't go to these events.
They don't know how to talk to. Like, I know this. I know I'll sound like an old man saying this, but I think there's a danger that the next generation, younger people, not just in the horse world, it's so digital, and then a combination of it's like the compound effect of COVID. It's really harming people's ability to communicate in person. It's so much easier to stay at home and so comfortable, or like go off. You have the option of like tuning into something online or watch it back later. It doesn't compare, because it's a lot of the time it's not about what was said on stage or by the speaker. It's what was said with the person next to you, what connection was made when you were grabbing a cup of coffee. That's the stuff you can't get online. We can make connections like this online, but I wouldn't like to be doing all in person. I wouldn't like to be doing all online. What has allowed me to develop a network that I don't see 90% of breeders that I know having is because I have put so much effort into doing both. Connecting with people online, finding excuses to connect with people online, sharing things or encouraging them or promoting what they're doing. But then I have so often I'll get into a car and it might be a pain in the ass. It might be 2 or 3 hours drive each way, but it's like something good will come out of it. Go to it. You have to be the Swedish version.
Yeah.
Somebody has to do it.
Somebody has to do it.
So why not you?
Yeah. And I also know, in fact, that a lot of, maybe especially breeders or older people are having these conversations as well, that why are not young people joining this event?
Yeah. So every country wants young people.
So they would probably be happy as well.
But also the fact that like you're going to be a younger person, you're younger and female. And like there's such a small amount, especially at breeders. I think it's getting better. I think more riders are getting interested in breeding because I think they have to, because more of them are breeding, or more of them are maybe starting to realize that it is a good way to get horses and get owners and that sort of thing. But I still think not enough. When you're the young person or you're the young rider that turns up at these things, it's like, oh, that's interesting. That's clever. That's a good idea. Oh, I like how she does things. Maybe that's who I'm going to give my whatever 4-year-old that I think is going to be a superstar.
Yeah, I have to look up groups and events.
And if you need any extra motivation, if you haven't ever contacted Emma Thorian Helston, then
I should.
You should. She is a fantastic person. Definitely reach out to her, because I think Sweden's lucky to have her. You'll be really happy that you made the connection. I think a conversation with her would really help you navigate Sweden as well.
That can also be a homework then.
Lots to do.
I have lots to do. But that's fun.
If you really want this, no more excuses. And I want you to update me. I want you to send a message, say, I've contacted this breeders group, or I'm joining them, or I'm going to this event, or I just went to this industry event. Actually, with some of the Swedish people, for example, last year I spent quite a bit of time with the Swedish group. The year before, we go for dinner, we visit breeders together. We went to Demuse, we went to Katanaya, we went somewhere else. And it's super, because maybe 3, 4, 5 of them will travel over together. And it's what I'd like to see you doing, and especially with other younger breeders, riders. It's so much easier. Yeah. Like, we book an Airbnb together, we have a rental car together. It makes it so much cheaper, so much easier, more fun. And a lot easier than to just turn up at some random old breeder.
That's true. Have a great evening. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Bye for now.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?